It's time to wake up. Stay tuned for Free Thought Radio, the only weekly Free Thought Radio broadcast anywhere. A production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation featuring co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Godless infidels, I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and welcome to the next hour of Free Thought Radio, the only weekly Free Thought Radio broadcast in the nation, offering slightly irreverent views, news, music, and interviews. We're broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin.
And I'm Dan Barker, your co-host for the show, your friendly neighborhood atheist. Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We're a national association, the largest association in the country of freethinkers. Freethinkers is a single word, and it refers to atheists and agnostics and other types of non-believers. We work to defend the constitutional principle of the separation of church and state. We have a really good show today. We're really happy to have as our guest, a little later in the show, the author Sam Harris, whose book, The End of Faith, has sold more than 225,000 copies. So you'll be excited to hear what he has to say about his new book, Letter to a Christian Nation, coming up later. It was fun last Saturday. We drove up to Fighting Bob Fest in Baraboo and the fairgrounds there, and it was fun meeting a lot of listeners to this show. We actually now have proof that somebody's listening to our show on a Saturday morning. So those of you who get up early, and thanks for coming by the booth and for those nice comments. And we should have brought more of our infidel sweatshirts. It was kind of cold that day, wasn't it?
And I did want to say that looking around at all the other booths, there's so many causes out there, so many good causes and important causes, and I signed a bunch of petitions. But we're pleased to those listeners who do keep in mind that one of the most important causes today is defending the constitutional wall of separation between church and state. There's nothing really, I think, more important that a person can do than work to defend the First Amendment.
Well, even some religious people were coming up, you know,
that's
saying,
right,
thank you for your work, because it protects all of us and whatever our views are, you know.
And we're excited to report that we'll be talking next week with author Richard Dawkins, and it's going to be our first transatlantic interview because he's in Oxford, and he's the evolutionary biologist. You may have read The Selfish Gene or The Blind Watchmaker. His great new book, that's not quite out, is called The God Delusion, and Dan and I have a proof copy that's autographed, and it really is good. So please stay tuned next week, Saturday, September 23rd, to hear that interview. And the following week, we'll be talking with the very lively Michelle Goldberg, who's the author of Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. We have a great lineup for the rest of September, so keep listening.
Now, we usually try to find a light way to start each show. And since this past week was the birth week of the great iconoclast and the irreligious journalist H.L. Mencken, I'd like to read a few of his classic epigrams. Sunday school, Mencken defined as a prison in which children do penance for the evil conscience of their parents. Another epigram was faith may be defined briefly as an illogical belief in the occurrence of the improbable. In a magazine called Minority Report in 1956, he said, the chief contribution of Protestantism to human thought is its massive proof that God is a bore. Sunday, a day given over by Americans to wishing that they themselves were dead and in heaven, and that their neighbors were dead and in hell. Theology, an effort to explain the unknowable by putting it into terms of the not worth knowing. In the American Mercury, H.L. Mencken pointed out, "The most curious social convention of the great age in which we live is the one to the effect that religious opinions should be respected." That was in the American Mercury in March 1930, which is something we'll be talking more about with our guest today, Sam Harris.
But first, we're starting a little new feature with Free Thought Radio. We're going to have a weekly disbelief quiz. We'll ask you a question and give the answer at the end of the show. Let's test your knowledge. Which famous figure from history made the following statement? And I'll give you three choices. The statement is, "Leave the matter of religion to the family altar, the church, and the private school, supported entirely by private contributions. Keep the church and the state forever separate."
And your choices are A, Joseph Stalin, B, President Ulysses S. Grant, or C, Karl Marx.
We'll tell you the source of that quote at the end of our show.
And if you want to have a, if you want to sneak and look up the answer, you can go to our webpage. We have a state church quiz on our webpage at ffrf.org that I think it has this answer on it. Before we get Sam Harris on the phone, we have just a little news on the state church front this week.
Because there's none like Thomas Jefferson and the wall between church and state. We got to fight the battle of church and state, church and state, church and state. We got to fight the battle of church and state, or the wall will come tumbling down.
This week, our president, George W. Bush, told a group of conservative journalists that he sees a third awakening of religious devotion in the United States that coincides with his war against terrorism, which he characterized as a confrontation between good and evil.
According to the Washington Post, George Bush said, "A lot of people in America see this as a confrontation between good and evil, including me. There was a stark change between the culture of the 50s and the 60s. Boom, and I think there's a change happening here. It seems to me that there's a third awakening."
Now, the first and second so-called awakenings in the U.S. were actually kind of the antithesis of an awakening. They were against the Enlightenment. They were times of widespread religious revival and a push to promote Christianity in government. The other troubling aspect to Bush's remarks was his reference to slavery and Abraham Lincoln, in which Bush said that it was a religious movement that was largely responsible for ending slavery. And, of course, that's a whitewash in history. In fact, the earliest proponents of abolition were infidels. Thomas Paine, who wrote The Age of Reason, the word infidel was synonymous with abolitionist. It was a derisive term by religionists. There were some unorthodox, some early unorthodox Quakers, but it was largely those people who did not believe in the Bible, since the Bible sanctioned slavery. Now, Lincoln liked to invoke the Almighty, but he was by no means an Orthodox Christian. He was a deist. If you go see the Lincoln Memorial, you'll see that he wrote in his second inaugural address in 1868 about the North and the South, quote, "Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other." So we see a troubling aspect when we see our president talk about a third awakening tied to the war against terrorism.
I think what Bush needs himself is a first awakening, an enlightenment of his own. I'm Dan Barker, here with Annie Laurie Gaylor on Free Thought Radio. And right after our break, we will go to our interview with Sam Harris. I'm Dan Barker, and I'm here with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. And we are back. And let's go right to our interview with Sam Harris, whom we have on the phone. Sam Harris is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason. He's a graduate in philosophy from Stanford University. He studied both Eastern and Western religious traditions for 20 years. Sam Harris is completing a doctorate in neuroscience. That'll be fun to talk about. His work has been discussed in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Chicago Tribune, the Economist, the Guardian, the Independent, the Globe and Mail, New Scientist, and many other journalists. you've seen and heard him regularly on TV and radio to discuss the danger that religion now poses to modern societies. The End of Faith won the 2005 Penn Award for Nonfiction. Mr. Hare's second book, entitled Letter to a Christian Nation, has just been published this September by Knopf, and we just had the pleasure of reading the book yesterday. Sam Harris will be speaking at the 29th Annual Convention of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in San Francisco on October 6th. And if you want to know more about that, check out our convention details at ffrf.org. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thank you so much, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for agreeing.
Now, you were just in the Newsweek last week. The September 11th issue had an article called The New Naysayers, and it featured your book.
Got very lucky with that, actually. Yeah. Dawkins and Dan Dennett were also profiled there. And, yeah, they were responding to this recent spate of free thought books that have hit the bestseller list.
Well, how did you feel? Angle. How did you feel with your picture between Dawkins and Dennett? I mean,
you mean the caricature that made us all look like vampires?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I imagine a faithful hand might have been penning those drawings.
Yeah.
They were not flattering to anyone concerned. But it was the article did us a lot of good. I mean, it pushed the books and it got this argument out to many people who read Newsweek but don't read anything much more critical than that.
Now, the article points out that you started your book, The End of Faith, on September 12th. 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what the treatise of your book is for someone who hasn't read it?
Yeah, well, in The End of Faith, I argue that we really are paying a terrible price for not criticizing people's religious certainties. I mean, our world really has been shattered by competing religious orthodoxies, which are themselves not justifiable, and leading people to subscribe to a moral community which is not the entirety of the species, but we have Muslims being Muslims, Christians being Christians, and they tend to side with one another in any kind of conflict on the basis of this religious affiliation. So it's leading to schisms in our world across which conflicts are arising, and people are getting killed because of it. And these are not conflicts that would be happening otherwise, as many people think. So in The End of Faith, I take a very hard line against religious faith and argue that even moderate religious people, the religious moderates and liberals, are part of the problem because they insist that religious faith never be criticized, because they want their own kind of benign religiosity respected across the board. They really provide a lot of cover for fundamentalists, because religious moderates and liberals don't want to locate the problem ever with religion itself. And therefore, they're in continual denial about the role that religious belief is playing in underwriting human violence. For instance, suicide bombing among Muslims.
Well, this leads to a question I had about the Newsweek article, where it kind of took pot shots at you and Dawkins in particular, and said, "Well, atheists can be fundamentalists." I mean, they were criticizing you for bringing up the passages against slavery in the Bible.
Right.
And calling that fundamentalist. Now, I'd like you to have your chance to answer that.
Yeah, well, I think this is something you get into a lot in dialogue with religious moderates. They'll, whether they're Christian or Muslim, you cite the barbarous passages in the Bible, and what a moderate will come back with, or a liberal will come back with, is, well, that's not really to be taken seriously. That was just true then, or that's, who knows how that should be interpreted. Clearly, we can't kill people for not being virgins on their wedding night, as it recommends in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And so moderates get their moderation by cherry-picking the
Yes.
Bible and the Quran. And they do this because much of the contents of those books really is perfectly barbarous and perfectly at odds with living in a civil society. But the problem is that moderates don't admit that this cherry-picking is on shaky ground intellectually. I mean, there's no place in the Bible where God says, you don't have to take me literally, or, I'm telling you to kill people for breaking the Ten Commandments here.
But don't do as I say.
Yeah, but when you get to the new world and develop three branches of government, you don't really have to take me seriously. I mean, clearly we are meant to kill people for working on the Sabbath or taking the Lord's name in vain, and the list is endless.
And being homosexuals not being a virgin on your wedding night.
Or being wizards.
Being a blasphemous person.
Yeah.
Denying God.
And it's not an accident that we were under the aegis of Christianity, killing people for five long centuries in Europe for a long list of theological offenses. I mean, this is not... That was actually not a perfect aberration of the Bible. You can get that out of the Bible. And St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas both thought torture was and killing of heretics was totally appropriate. In Augustine's case, he argued for torture, and that laid the basis for the Inquisition. And in Aquinas' case, he thought heretics should be killed outright. And this actually makes sense if you think believing the wrong things about God leads to an eternity of suffering, and therefore anyone who advocates the wrong beliefs about God poses the threat of contagion to society. I mean, if your neighbor convinces your child of the wrong things about God, your child is going to spend eternity in hell. And so this makes the heretic a very dangerous person. It's just in the West, and even in America, even among fundamentalists in America, people have learned over the last 200 years that kind of literalism is untenable, and that's a good thing, and this lesson really hasn't been learned to the same degree in the Muslim world. But the problem with what religious moderates are doing here is they are denying the contents of the book because they're overlooking them. They're not even reading the Bible with much attention these days. And the contents don't change. I mean, it is possible for someone to pick up the Bible today and discover all of the barbarism and all the reasons to be intolerant that the Bible provides. And as long as we legitimize this notion that one book, the Bible, was not written by ordinary people, it's not ordinary literature, it's somehow divine, and therefore is not subject to the same kind of criticism, and we should build institutions that venerate this book, and we should raise our children to believe that somehow they're living under the shadow of this book as Christians or Jews, as long as we don't call any of that into question, we keep these engines of intolerance alive, these books, which you open to today, you as a Christian can discover that Jesus is going to come back in 2 Thessalonians and with flaming fire, hurl sinners into the pit. And that's a Jesus that is there to be discovered, and the Jesus that is emphasized.
Oh, that's just a metaphor, Sam. Aren't you smart enough to know? We talk to these liberals all the time. We do debates with fundamentalists and liberals, and often they will wave their hand and say, "Oh, are you just as bad as the fundamentalists?" Well, then I ask them, "Well, if you think the Bible is so brutal, why don't you join us in denouncing and those ugly parts and throwing them out?" And they, instead of lending credibility to this book by refusing to speak out and be critical of it, and most liberals don't think they have an obligation to do what you and what we are trying to do in pointing out the dangers of, like what happened on 9/11. Did you see our ad in the Nation magazine this week? We just took out a 4-page ad.
No, I haven't seen that yet.
It's the pre 9/11 New York City skyline, and up in the clouds it says, "Picture a world free from religion," and you see the Twin Towers still standing.
Oh, nice. That's a very clever ad.
And Dawkins, like immediately after Richard Dawkins, immediately pointed at religion as the root cause. Why did they fly those planes into those buildings?
It was a faith-based act, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you were like us. You had the reaction that this should show the world the harm of blind faith, and yet the opposite seemed to happen, didn't it?
Yeah, that was the thing that really motivated me to write The End of Faith, because... I mean, it was appalling to see that we as a nation were attacked by religious faith. I mean, just unambiguously, this was these people had theological grievances and theological hopes for paradise. And in response to this, we had no other conceptual tools but to console ourselves with our own theology, and we were therefore, just as a culture, driven more deeply into the arms of the very thing that had attacked us, and began to speak in the most self-deceived and incredible ways about God being on our side and God
God bless America.
God not being indifferent between freedom and fear, and you know, we had a president who was speaking as the leader of a country in the 14th century, and using words like crusade,
yes,
quite unreflectively. And then on top of all of that, we deny that any of this stuff is really coming out of the theology of Islam. That it's as though the doctrines of martyrdom and jihad were totally irrelevant here, and Islam is a religion of peace that is being hijacked by a Reverend Jim Jones figure.
That headline in The Onion last week about religious factions find solace in their religious beliefs in the Middle East? It was really funny, you know. They turned to the very thing that's tearing them apart, you know.
That was a very clever article.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a huge, this denial of the causative power of belief is a huge problem in the liberal and moderate community. It's ironically not a problem among fundamentalists. I mean, our religious fundamentalists are the ones who speak most candidly and most clearly about the moral problems in the Muslim world and the moral distinctions between the kind of violence that Muslim suicide bombers use in the Middle East and the defensive violence, for the most part, that is prosecuted by the Israelis. I mean, if you read liberals and moderates on this subject, they're completely at sea because they don't know what it's like to be motivated by their own theology. I mean, they in some sense, don't really believe in God, or at least they're not certain of God or certain of paradise, and therefore they really can't believe anyone else is. And they, you know, they think that people are blowing themselves up because they don't have enough economic opportunities, or because they don't have enough education, which is, you know, as I've said many times, I don't know how many more engineers and architects need to hit the wall at 400 miles an hour for us to realize that this is not a problem merely of economics or education.
Yeah, exactly. The religious liberals, for whatever faults they may have, they're at least to be complimented for rising above. You know, most of them are smarter than the God of the Bible. They're kinder than Jesus was, and at least they have risen above that brutality, and most of them work for liberal causes. So.
But they're in denial about the far-reaching harm of religious conviction, unexamined religious conviction. Yeah. We are going to take a short break and be right back with Free Thought Radio and continue our interview with the fascinating Sam Harris.
We've discussed all sorts of religions. This is Dan Barker with Free Thought Radio, and my co-host is Annie Lori Gaylor. And we've come down hard on Christianity and Islam and other religions, but one thing we have been neglecting is another nefarious religious belief, that is the belief in reincarnation.
And today's song, and we're going to be right back with Sam Harris after it plays, is Reincarnation, and that comes from a poem by the well-known cowboy poet, Wallace D. McRae. It's Just Grass and Water. His poem's from 1986. And Dan asked Wallace McRae for permission to set his rather irresistible rhyme to music. He received it. Let's listen.
What does reincarnation mean? A cowpoke asked his friend. His pal replied, it happens when your life has reached its end. They comb your hair and wash your neck and clean your fingernails and lay you in a padded box away from life's travails. The box in you goes in a hole that's been dug into the ground. Reincarnation starts in when you're planted neath a mound. Them clods melt down just like your box and you who is inside. And then you're just beginning on your transformation ride. In a while, the grass will grow upon your rendered mound. Till someday on your moldered grave, a lonely flower is found. And say a hoss should wander by and graze upon this flower. that once was you but now's become your vegetative bower. That the hoss done ate up with his other feed makes bone and fat and muscle essential to the steed, but some is left that he can't use, and so it passes through and finally lays upon the ground this thing that once was you. Then say by chance I wanders by and sees this on the ground, and I ponders and I wonders at this object that I found. I thinks of reincarnation, of life and death and such, and come away concluding, Slim, you ain't changed all that much.
That was the song Reincarnation, words by Wallace D. McRae, music, vocals, and piano by Dan Barker from the CD Friendly Neighborhood Atheist, available from ffrf.org.
I'm Dan Barker with Free Thought Radio, and we're still on the phone with Sam Harris, the author of End of Faith, which we've been discussing, and he's also the author of a brand new book, which we just got yesterday, a wonderful small book. It's called Letter to a Christian Nation. I sat down and read it cover to cover, and it's short. It's like reading a long letter from a friend. And the book sums up, I think, centuries of atheistic and skeptical and critical literature that have been written for a long time. What Sam seems to have done in this book is he's put it all into sort of like a poem. He's taken a novel and put it into a poem. You can sit down and read through this and pretty much see and read and hear and feel everything that we non-believers are feeling about religion. So Sam, you're still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, so tell us, this book just came out, this month?
Yeah, it's the official pub date is September 19th, but I think it's probably in stores at the moment. It's my response to the response I received to my first book, The End of Faith. Because The End of Faith was published in a country where 83% of the people believe that Jesus literally rose from the dead, most of the critical response I got was from Christians, and I got thousands of emails, mostly, and many of these argued that I'm wrong not to believe in God, and here's why. And initially, I began to respond to all of these individually, but they came in such torrents that I developed a form letter that I would send out to each flavor of critic. I had a Muslim form letter, a Christian form letter, an atheist form letter, even for the atheists who didn't like what I said about meditation. And so the Christian form letter would often get returned to me with commentary from devout Christians. And so I kind of went to school on their response. And it's amazing how, it's not like there are 1,000 arguments in defense of God. I mean, they're really surprisingly few. And so once I had a sense of where their thinking, the tracks in which their thoughts were running, just reliably, really with every response. I mean, there are very few surprises in the kinds of responses you get in defense of God. I just thought I could write the whopper of all form letters, so I titled it, I think unsurprisingly, Letter to a Christian Nation.
I like how you handled the definition of atheism, where you say that it's not really a world philosophy or a moral philosophy. There's a sentence on page 51 where you say, atheism is nothing more than the noises reasonable people make in the presence of unjustified religious beliefs. I think that's a great line. It's not like we're trying to be an anti-religion. We're just objecting to these things that they raise. You mentioned the problem of evil. You mentioned the horrible Bible verses in here. You mentioned slavery. You analyzed the Ten Commandments. I also like that little analysis you have in there on stem cell research, comparing the 180 cells of the embryo with the brain of a fly. And what do we think when we squash a fly, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the most damaging things that religious beliefs do. On questions of morality, which is really the kind of the first thing on everyone's list as to why religion must be protected from criticism, is this idea that we get our morality out of religion. First of all, we clearly don't, and that's something I argue against in the book. But the thing that is relevant to the stem cell debate is that religion divides questions of morality from the reality of human suffering. I mean, religious people will spend vast amounts of time focusing on questions where there's really no suffering hangs in the balance, or at least it's never argued that much suffering hangs in the balance. Something like gay marriage comes to mind. I mean, Christians debate this as though this were the greatest moral question of the 21st century, and yet no one is really arguing that more people are going to suffer as a result of gay marriage than of, you know, any other development in our society. And you know, with stem cell research, they will lavish all of this moral concern on 3-day-old human embryos, which are undifferentiated, virtually microscopic collections of cells.
Blastocysts.
And, 150 cells arranged in a sphere, no brain, no nervous system, no neurons even. And yet, they will privilege those cells over little girls with spinal cord injuries and men and women with Parkinson's. And they never have to make the argument that they are, on balance, making the wise decision in terms of human suffering, because they're actually not worried about suffering. They're worried about offending God and living by the lights of, worried about sin and, you know, theological and metaphysical principles.
Well, if their actions and beliefs result in more harm in the world than would have been, then actually they are the ones who are immoral.
Yeah, I mean, certainly by any rational construal of morality, they are, yes. And there are just many places you can see this. I mean, another example I bring up in the book is that, you know, there are many reasons to go to Africa and help people. I mean, the people living in Africa right now, and particularly in countries like Sudan, are just horribly unlucky to be born there amid interminable wars and unchecked disease, et cetera. And, you know, good people in our society go over there and help rather often. Now, there are two types of people who do this, generally speaking. There are religious people who do it for religious reasons, you know, evangelical Christians and Catholic missionaries. And then there are secular people, like people who work for Doctors Without Borders. And there are real differences between what they do, which really have to be noticed. I mean, they're all good people motivated by compassion, presumably. But the Christians go over there and preach about the sinfulness of condom use in countries where literally millions of people die annually from AIDS. I mean, this is just genocidally stupid. They also preach the necessity of believing in the divinity of Jesus Christ in countries like the Sudan, where literally millions of people have died as a result of civil wars between Christians and Muslims. It's just unconscionable, this behavior, and yet they think somehow that the fact that they're ministering to the needs of the poor there proves the validity of Christianity, which of course it doesn't.
Well, even Jesus said, "The poor you have with you always." You know, so don't try to work to improve the social situation.
And unfortunately, a lot of this preaching of abstinence and religion is now being done with our federal tax dollars under the Faith-Based Initiative.
Yeah, and we're denying money to groups that merely mention abortion.
Yeah, the global ban.
Yeah.
So we really do have sort of the fundamentalists hijacking some of our government right now.
Yeah, that's another thing that I think moderates and liberals have been slow to realize, just how powerful and how organized and how influential some of these groups are. I mean, we're talking about organizations that have operating budgets of tens of millions of dollars a year, in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and their sole purpose is to spread these ideas, like, you know, the world is likely to come to an end in the next 50 years, and Jesus is going to come down out of the clouds and rapture all the good people into the sky. I mean, this is literally what these people believe, and these are people who can get a meeting with the president. So, I mean, it should be terrifying to any rational person that we, the most powerful and influential society in human history, are being guided by people who, in many cases, think the world is going to end in their lifetime and think it will end gloriously.
That's what I used to think. And when I was a preacher, you know, for years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I used to go around thinking, I'm never going to even grow up to have a family. I better win souls for Jesus. You know? Faith and fear are powerfully motivating. And we moderate rationalists, we can't scare people with hell, you know. I mean, but the religious right can scare people to death and get them to go out and contribute tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
Sam, I wanted to ask you, since you brought up the president, this week he made this statement about the Third Awakening. I don't know if you caught that.
Yeah, I caught some of it, yeah.
And he made some allusions to the idea that it was really Christianity that ended slavery that's responsible for the abolition movement.
Right.
And in your book, your new book, you talk a little bit about slavery.
Yeah.
Could you say something briefly about what the Bible really says about slavery?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, if the Bible is the Word of God and therefore by definition the best book we have on morality, it should get the most basic questions of morality right. And, you know, one question of morality that really is no longer a question is this question of slavery. We all agree that slavery was an abomination. There's no person in our society who could claim to be moral and in the same breath claim to think slavery is something we should practice. And yet, if you consult the Bible, you find that on balance, it argues for the legitimacy of slavery. God tells us how to keep slaves. He tells you how you can sell your daughter into slavery. He simply admonishes slaveholders not to beat their slaves so badly that that you knock out their eyes or their teeth, because then you have to set them free. But slavery is nowhere criticized in the Bible. And in the New Testament, Jesus does not criticize slavery, and he uses slaves as examples in his parables. He clearly thought the institution of slavery was going to endure. St. Paul admonishes slaves to serve their masters well, and to serve their Christian masters especially well. And slavery is simply endorsed by the Bible.
Okay, but Jesus was compassionate enough to suggest that there are some slaves that you ought not to beat as hard as others,
because
they didn't know better. So I'm giving him a little slack here.
Yeah, and you can cherry pick the Bible, of course, and take a line like love your neighbor as yourself, and use that as a lens through which to view all of these questions as moderates and liberals do, and then say, well, how can you love your neighbor as yourself and practice slavery? Well, fine, that's great. An abolitionist did that, of course, but the real truth is that the slaveholders of the South were on firmer ground, theologically speaking, and they knew it, and they made a lot of noise about it. And so, you know, this, I think, discredits the Bible just in principle from being the best book we have on morality. I mean, I really think you could walk blindfolded into the self-help section of any bookstore and find a book far less offensive and far more informative about morality than the Bible.
Well, how about people going to bookstores and finding your book?
You know, it should, hopefully, if the publisher does their job, it should be easy to find next week.
And also The End of Faith, which is out in paperback and has a really nice, I really enjoy the afterword that you added.
Uh-huh.
About the reaction, and it goes through a lot of the typical questions you got and is very well written. And then you have your new book that we have available already at the Freedom from Religion Foundation. People can order either of your book, The Letter to Christian Nation or End of Faith from FFRF.org, and they can come and see you at our 29th annual convention in San Francisco, October 6th.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm very glad you guys are doing that.
We're looking forward to meeting you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thanks, Sam. It's been really been fun.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Great.
Join the nonprofit Educational Freedom from Religion Foundation. We educate, we litigate, and now we broadcast. A national association of free thinkers, atheists, and agnostics working to defend the wall of separation between church and state. Ask for a sample of the Foundation's newspaper, Free Thought Today, or learn more about our legal challenges to protect the constitutional separation of church and state. For more information, visit www.ffrf.org or phone 608-256-8900. We hope someday you'll join us. Freethinker's Almanac is a production of Free Thought Radio. To learn more about the contributions of non-believers to social progress, check out Free Thought of the Day at the Freedom From Religion Foundation's website, www.ffrf.org.
The answer to this week's disbelief quiz? Who said, leave the matter of religion to the family altar, the church, and the private school, supported entirely by private contributions? Keep the church and state forever separate? Why, that was President Ulysses S. Grant in his speech at Des Moines, Iowa in 1875. Grant was a strict absolutist on state church questions. He didn't like the idea of taxes not being levied to churches. He was greatly admired by many in his day, including Mark Twain, and his job in office is being reevaluated by many historians today.
I'm Dan Barker here with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. This show is produced by the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin. Our engineer today is Brian Turani. Our announcer is Buzz Kemper from Audio for the Arts. This show can be heard at ffrf.org, where all of our past shows have been archived. If you want to make a comment or a criticism or just want to give us some advice, you're welcome to phone 608-663-7291. That's the Progressive Hotline, 608-663-7291. Or just to let us know that you're listening. If you want, you can send us an email, freethoughtradio@ffrf.org.
Thanks for listening to Free Thought Radio. Thanks to our guest, Sam Harris. Don't miss our exclusive interview on Free Thought Radio with Richard Dawkins, who is a passionate secularist, a thoroughly well-informed atheist, the leading rationalist advocate in the United Kingdom and Europe, and one of Free Thought's most eloquent spokespersons. Tune in next week.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, www.ffrf.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by co-hosts Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
Brotherhood.